with the stirring music from the North Carolina Reading Service, Glee, Purdue, Marching, and Chowder Society Kazoos, here comes the Indie Week. I'm John Federson, and I'm reading this issue for our blind and print-impaired listeners. The issue is dated January the 12th of 2023. The kazoos march off, and we'll have them back at the end of our broadcast today. Let's get to it. All right, our print edition and the online edition of Indie Week are fairly much in step this week. And the feature story is called Stuck in Traffic by Jasmine Gallup. For more than 15 years, Michelle Durst commuted from Cary to North Raleigh for her full-time job in sales. At first, the drive wasn't too bad. She says, I would get off at the exit at Tryon, then get off at Wake Forest. Traffic would be pretty much keep moving. Then, as time went on, the Cary traffic going into Raleigh became so bad, I would start taking back roads. Today, that 30-mile commute can take up to an hour or even more if there's a car accident or construction, which seems constantly ongoing. Like many people, Durst began working from home following the outbreak of COVID. She sells windows and doors, so although in-person engagements were limited, business was still booming. She says, thank goodness I don't have to do the drive now with all the road construction on I-440 because it's even worse. I'll go in occasionally for appointments in the showroom, but I can schedule them around rush hour. During the pandemic, many daily commuters found relief in working from home, getting back two or more hours they had previously spent in traffic. But the drive from Raleigh to Durham, which thousands of people take every day, is still one of the most congested in the Triangle, with I-40 narrowing to just two lanes west of exit 270, the interchange with US 15501. According to government officials, public transportation may be the solution. The Triangle's rush hour commute is nothing compared to hours-long gridlocks drivers face in cities like Atlanta, Houston, or Washington, D.C. But with so many people pouring into the area, commuters could be dealing with similar traffic conditions within the next 30 years, experts predict. The population of the Triangle is expected to climb from 1.6 million today to 2.5 million by 2050. That's a 56% increase, according to the NC Office of State Budget and Management. Consequently, drive times from Raleigh to Durham and around the Beltline are expected to shoot up, far surpassing the 45 to 60-minute commute many drivers currently deal with. As of 2016, traffic on I-40 and 440 ranged from moderately congested during rush hour to consistently congested throughout and beyond the peak hours of travel, according to a report released last year from the NC Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. They have a good acronym, NCCAMPO. In the words of social media commenters, the traffic is god-awful, a nightmare, and horrible and getting worse. When one aspiring commuter asked for tips for the commute between Raleigh and Durham, online commenters suggested a teleporter, helicopter, or fast-acting anti-anxiety medication. I-40 and 440 are expected to be even more bogged down by traffic by 2050, even during non-peak hours. Moreover, back roads around these major highways will also face high traffic congestion, where traffic is now relatively free-flowing. What is the commuter rail project? This problem isn't a new one. County officials started taking a closer look at the area's transport system more than a decade ago, back when growth was still relatively slow. In 2011, voters in Durham County approved a half-cent tax increase to fund expanded bus service, a light rail line, and a regional commuter rail line. 37 miles of track that would connect Garner to Raleigh to Durham, sharing existing railway lines. County Commissioner Brenda Howerton says Durham needs good local and regional public transit. Our Durham County Transit Plan outreach revealed that the rail project had support as one element of a robust, comprehensive public transit system. Likewise, voters in Wake County also approved a half-cent tax increase to fund expanded bus service and support the commuter rail project, which at the time was still a rough proposal yet to be studied in depth. Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch, also a board member for Go Triangle, which operates the Triangle's public transport and plans future improvement projects, says, as people continue to move to Raleigh, we have to find a way to get ahead of road congestion. We're starting to become a society where owning a car is a challenge. So if you don't have a vehicle, how do you get around? How do we connect people to jobs and social activities? Since voters approved the tax increase, Raleigh has taken significant steps to improve bus service but remains stalled on commuter rail. The Durham Light Rail Project, meant to connect Durham to Chapel Hill with 18 miles of track, is now infamous for crashing and burning in early 2019. The project cost taxpayers in Durham and Orange counties $157 million before ultimately failing, thanks in part to Duke University pulling its support. Charles Latuca, president of Go Triangle, says if you ask 10 people why Durham Light Rail failed, you get 10 different answers. Some people say it was Duke, some people say it was Norfolk Southern, and some people will say the state kept moving the goalpost on the money. Go Triangle has learned its lesson from the Durham Light Rail project, Latuca says. Part of the reason it failed was because solid agreements were not in place before design and engineering work began. This time, Go Triangle plans to get solid agreements before they start spending money. He says, I don't spend a lot of time dwelling on who's responsible. What I do try to spend time on is identifying risk and making sure we are appropriately addressing it. This time around, we're doing a better job making sure that our key stakeholders, meaning North Carolina Railroad, Norfolk Southern, Duke, and other institutional stakeholders, are on board before we start spending a lot of money. Following the failure of Durham Light Rail, Go Triangle officials restarted work on the regional commuter rail, releasing a new feasibility study just last week. The study paints an inspiring picture of the future of public transport in the Triangle, but the project faces major challenges. The proposed commuter rail could cost up to $3.2 billion. Far more than local counties can afford, even if the federal government supplied half the funding, according to the study. Getting that federal funding is also a challenge. The Triangle's population is too low right now to qualify for a major federal grant called the New Starts Program, which covers 50% of the cost of major transit projects. Latuca says, I don't think the program does a good job of taking into account rapidly urbanizing areas like Raleigh. It does a great job of taking into account heavily urbanized areas like New York and Baltimore and D.C., but for us, we don't have that population density yet. There are federal loans the project might qualify for, where the Triangle would borrow 100% of the money needed for commuter rail and then pay back all of it within the next few decades. Overall, that option could be less expensive than the New Starts program, which requires payment up front, according to Laduca. Quote, the good thing about these loan programs is the payback doesn't start until after the project starts operating. So if it takes you 10 years to build, you don't have to pay anything back until after you start running trains, and then they let you pay it back over 35 years. If you look at the impact on local transit dollars, it actually might even be less than the 50-50 program. Overall, the commuter rail project is just too expensive to build all at once, as originally planned. Instead, Go Triangle is proposing to build a project in phases. But that project also comes with its own problems. As expensive as commuter rail is now, it will be even more expensive as time passes because of inflation. Latuca says inflation is eating up the dollars like crazy. The bipartisan infrastructure law that Congress passed back in the summer was a huge amount of money. About $1 billion of that got eaten up by inflation in 1 year. If I can build one of those sections now instead of later, that would save us hundreds of millions of dollars. The commuter rail project is currently divided into three phases: an eastern section going from Auburn Station in Garner to Raleigh's Union Station, a central section going from Raleigh to the new station RTP, and a western section going from RTP through Durham. The central section could potentially involve a relocation of Cary's Amtrak station, by the way. For years, officials have aspired to connect Raleigh to Durham through public transport, but the western section of commuter rail, which does just that, is by far the most expensive and complicated section to build. The 10 miles of track connecting the proposed RTP station to West Durham is expected to cost $1.6 billion and take 12 years to build, according to the study. Howerton says, the study has shown that there are significant infrastructure and cost challenges for the project, particularly in Durham. Commuter rail in Durham will require a longer-term approach, reduced cost, and or additional revenue sources in order to make it happen. Latuca puts it more bluntly. Durham to RTP is the least affordable phase. We think the middle phase is very affordable, and then the short 10-mile phase in the east is really affordable. If you think of the project as 40 miles, the middle segment is only $1 billion. You're delivering almost half the project for one-third the cost. One of the biggest issues with that western section is only a single track goes through the area, and trains often stop on it for hours at a time to unload and load goods in East Durham's rail yard. The delay presents a major problem for a commuter train, which would run about 40 trips per day, says Latuca. A commuter railway would require building all new tracks in the area, an expensive prospect. Not only that, but building track through downtown Durham also presents challenges, since the city has numerous low bridges that trains cannot pass beneath. Construction would involve closing some streets and doing major renovations on others. In order to start construction on the commuter rail, all parties involved have to agree to a plan on how and when to build it. Not only do North Carolina Railroad, Norfolk Southern, and a host of other agencies have to get on board, but Wake, Durham, and Johnston County commissioners then have to agree to fund the project as outlined. One of the major points of conflict is over which part of the rail will be built first. Starting with the eastern and central sections of the commuter rail would be much easier, but connecting these areas is also much less of a priority for Durham commissioners. Latuca says it's problematic because we have an early goal of connecting Durham and Raleigh, but that western section would have to come at some other point in time. If we were to build the middle phase, we would work toward building out the entire system as proposed. It would just take longer. It's causing some frustration with folks. Howerton says the commuter rail needs to include a strong regional transit connection to downtown Durham, the Go Durham bus system, and Durham's population and employment centers. She added, the central and eastern segments fall short of that and would require alternative transit service connections through central Durham. We want to hear from the public on if the phased approach would be a good option and or if we should consider other regional solutions. Durham has to be a part of the regional transit system no matter what approach is taken. Go Triangle is asking for input on its commuter rail plan. The public comment period is open through February 19th. One of the goals of gathering this input is to determine which phase should be built first, or whether the planned sections should be modified, says Branch. It's all about identifying what that phase looks like that better serves the people. Latuca says it's not unusual for projects of this size to take decades to complete. Moving from design to engineering and land acquisition can take anywhere from 10 to 20 years before construction even starts. Building the railway can then take years more. The lengthy lead time for commuter rail isn't the project's biggest problem, however. The whole point of the Triangle Commuter Rail Project is to build for the future, for the people who will move to the Triangle in 2040 or later, according to Branch. Quote, "What we're building for is the next generation. I want to see a region where everyone has the ability to access opportunities to better the lives of their families. We have to make sure we are forward-thinking, because if we think about self, we'll never get anything done." In many major cities, the process of building large, complex, and expensive transit projects began after the population had already boomed, says Latuca. Quote, "In Maryland and D.C., we were trying to solve a problem that already existed. Here, we have the opportunity to solve a problem before it becomes bad. It's going to be much easier to acquire real estate when not everybody is up against the rail corridor. It's going to be a lot easier to build something now when the demand on the highway is not impossible." According to Latuca, commuter rail is only one piece of the overall solution. It's really a three-legged stool, he says. We need to have a lot of investment and growth in our local buses, and also these bus rapid transit projects that are being considered and built by Raleigh and Chapel Hill. What we have in Atlanta, Baltimore, and New York are transit systems. Here we don't have a unified transit system. Wake residents like Durst, who are burned out on commuting, say, for now, it's still probably easier to drive within the county than to use public transportation. Quote, "I wonder about the convenience of a commuter rail, depending on where you're picking it up and where it drops off." For longer trips, though, from Cary to Durham, for instance, Durst says she'd make an exception. "If I had to go into RTP, definitely I'd take public transport, because that traffic is crazy, crazy. But just around the Beltline, I probably would still drive." Now next, in Indy Week, a story about gun ownership, and it was published by a partnership between Indy and the Ninth Street Journal, which is produced by journalism students at Duke University. And the particular author is Charlotte Kramon, K-R-A-M-O-N. Up in arms, Andrea Muffin Hudson is an activist for incarcerated individuals, directs two criminal justice nonprofits, and believes prisons do catastrophic harm. She is also a gun owner. When Hudson, 47, drives around Durham, her G2C 9mm pistol sits beside her on the passenger seat. She carries it with her everywhere, wearing it like a fanny pack. She leaves her gun behind only when she goes to the Durham County Courthouse to pay cash bonds. Hudson lives with her son, 18, and daughter, 28. Her round cheeks frame her easygoing smile as words flow out, her deep voice suited to the seriousness of her work. Each room in Hudson's house has a gun in it, even the bathroom. She said, laughing, "So if you're in the bathroom and somebody breaks in while you're in the bathroom, you can protect yourself. You know, I watch a lot of movies." Gun violence in the United States spiked in 2020, the onset of the pandemic. In Durham, from 2019 to 2020, the number of shootings skyrocketed by almost 70%. But the city saw 721 shootings from early December 21 to early December 22. That's 188 fewer than in the same period 2 years earlier. Fatal shootings increased slightly. Gun control debates conjure images of white, conservative men who collect arms for sport. Today, a new population makes up a disproportionate percentage of first-time gun owners, people of color, especially women. Like Hudson, they don't use their guns for recreation. They own them for protection. In a study conducted between January 2019 and May 2021, researchers found 22% of black gun owners and 16% of Hispanic buyers had purchased arms for the first time in the 28 months prior to that survey. The same was true for just 8% of whites surveyed. Additionally, nearly half of first-time gun owners in 2020 and 2019 were women. During the same period, 7.5 million Americans bought guns for the first time. More recently, mass shootings in Raleigh, University of Virginia, Colorado Springs, and Chesapeake, Virginia, have drawn more attention to the issue of gun ownership. Some expected the Biden administration to impose stricter gun control measures, which accounts for a portion of the surge in gun ownership, said Becky Ciertas, executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. However, that's only part of the story. Donald Trump's presidency inflamed deep-seated racial animosity, lent new muscle and momentum to white nationalists, and stoked the fears of people like Hudson. She bought her first gun in 2017. Hudson, who is black, says, "I got it because Trump won, became president, and people were acting erratic. I was thinking that folks were going to start doing stuff to harm other people. I was thinking about The Walking Dead and Armageddon coming, and I wanted to give us a fighting chance to survive." Hudson's greatest fear is not people from her own community, but white men in America. She recalls when a white man shot and killed 9 black people at a Charleston church in 2015. She also points to Kyle Rittenhouse, who was not old enough to own a firearm and killed 2 people in Kenosha, Wisconsin, yet served no prison time. The pandemic has only amplified gun violence. Almost all recent increases in homicides resulted from gun violence, notes Phil Cook, a public policy and economic professor at Duke who studies the economics of crime. He says the objective threat level has gone way up in a short period of time. He believes a combination of tumultuous events has contributed to this increase. The pandemic stripped people of vital community services. Lockdowns caused, quote, young men to have more time on their hands and resort to gang violence, he said. At the same time, he said the police forces are weaker since the racial justice protests of 2020. Cook said having an effective police force is part of what creates public safety, and we lost some of that in 2020. To Hudson, police officers and the state are violent threats in and of themselves. In addition to police shootings, she believes that the incarceration and targeting of people of color, along with lack of mental health service and other resources, are a form of violence. She said, "We need protection from the government and the state. Fear of a tyrannical state has traditionally been associated with right-wing fringe groups, but Jeffrey W. Swanson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at the Center for Firearms Law at Duke Law School, says it's now migrated into the center of gun culture. The fraught relationship between people of color and law enforcement leaves Hudson feeling as though her only source of protection is her weapon. Gun ownership is the norm in many communities. A Duke University political scientist, Christian Goss, studies gun violence, and she says, in some places, it's literally an arms race. So, if nobody was armed, people probably wouldn't feel like they needed to be armed. Once other people start arming themselves, then you have this kind of counter effect of, you know, this place seems more dangerous, so I need to protect myself. Marcian Hall, 30, of Durham, grew up in Chicago. Based on what he has seen, he believes that criminals will purchase illegal guns or resort to other modes of violence. Hall, who is black, says a lot of people that are advocating for fewer or no guns are the people that have been more so sheltered their whole lives. Both of Hall's parents were in the military, owned guns, and taught him about firearm safety. Most of his friends' parents had guns, he said, and he knew others who obtained them illegally. Hall owns a security firm called Category 5 Protection and bought his first gun when he was 21. He has three children and owns several guns that he keeps locked in a safe, saying, I teach my children it's a tool that can give you an upper hand in situations, but not to play with them. In Hall's eyes, anyone who can legally own a gun should take advantage of that right, because not every instance of potential violence can be de-escalated. Still, Hall believes gun owners must be responsible. He suspects that people who conduct background checks are not as thorough as they should be. For Hudson, the arms race is not just among her community. It's among her community, white people, and law enforcement. Saying, in a perfect world, no one would need a weapon. But I think about all the people who have guns legally, who do the killing. Like when you think about police officers. You think about random young white men who go into gun stores, go in to get gun shows, get all these guns and all of these weapons. Yet Hudson says just because people like her own guns doesn't mean they want to use them. I would rather have it and not need it, she said, than need it and not have it. Mass shootings have dominated headlines since October. 5 dead in Raleigh, 5 killed in Colorado Springs, 6 in Chesapeake, Virginia, 3 football players at University of Virginia. Hudson said of the players, I think if the assailant didn't have a gun, they may still be dead. What if it was a knife? What if it was a car? Hudson speculated that the athletes must have done some harm to the suspect, adding, no matter what they did to this young man, they should still be here. Officials have disclosed no evidence of any conflict between the players and their assailant. Hall, though, thinks the gun sealed the athlete's fate. If the assailant had used a knife, a scenario with three men against one would not have resulted in death, Hall said. Still, he does not think that mass shootings should stop people from purchasing guns as a tool. In North Carolina, residents apply for a handgun permit through each county's sheriff's office. Applicants must meet certain criteria. North Carolina does not have red flag laws, which allow state courts to confiscate firearms from people who exhibit dangerous behavior, like domestic violence. There are also no restrictions on the types of weapons people can buy, for example, an assault rifle versus a semi-automatic rifle, or on the number of rounds of ammunition a magazine can hold. Andrew Willinger, executive director of Duke Center for Firearms Law, says North Carolina is middle of the road, or more permissive than other states. This could change with a U.S. Supreme Court decision last July. In New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, the court struck down as unconstitutional a New York law that required individuals to show proper cause before receiving a license to carry a concealed pistol or revolver outside the home. Goss said the case may encourage other lawsuits against state gun regulations. Idrissa A. Smith, a public defender for Durham County, says that violent crime is driven by systemic factors related to employment, education, culture, and financial strain. She's noted higher rates of gun ownership recently, particularly among juveniles. The attorney attributes this rise to several factors, including economic distress, the migrations of gangs toward the South, and fears of white supremacists. Smith, who is black, added that law enforcement and government agencies regulate and prosecute crime, but, quote, none of these institutions have anything to do with violent crimes. It's systemic. It goes to what's going on in people's homes, how people were raised, these people being us, our population, the environments we were put in, and our sensibilities. Several of Smith's fellow lawyers have become first-time gun owners in the last few years, but the lawyer vows never to buy one. District Attorney Satana DeBerry agrees violence is systemic. Critics charge that she has been soft on violent crime, but both Smith and Cook disagree. Still, DeBerry notes that violence has gone up across the country, not just in Durham. She says this proves the problem extends beyond local prosecution. DeBerry admires Durham's community efforts to reduce violence. For example, Haiti Reborn Justice Movement is a new coalition aiming to grow and maintain black wealth in Durham by investing in black businesses, bringing together community organizations, providing mentorship, and helping people find work. District Attorney spokeswoman Sarah Willits also highlighted the Duke Hospital Violence Intervention Program, the City of Durham's Prescriptions for Repair pilot program, and the Community Safety Department. DeBerry says, what I think is unique to Durham is our ability to really recognize when there was a challenge in 2020 and 21 and respond to that. There are hundreds of people in this community who are working on decreasing the amount of violence. When it comes to guns, DeBerry chooses not to own one. She grew up in the rural South with parents who lived through Jim Crow, and her father owned guns to protect his family. I'm unwilling to deal with the consequences of using it, said District Attorney DeBerry. My father always said, if you have a gun, you got to be willing to use it. Now I can go back to the online publication of Indie Week at the 9th Street Journal of January 11th of this year for an article that I had no time to read a couple of issues ago by Chloe Nguyen, called Meet the Pastor of an LGBTQ-affirming Church in Durham. In Atlanta, Georgia, in 1980, an aspiring pastor was not someone you'd expect to find at a drag show, but it was there that the Reverend Julia Webb Bowden, then a college senior, revealed to her recently out gay friend that she was considering ordination in the United Methodist Church. Her friend felt betrayed, she recalled. The church had added exclusive language to its book of discipline, declaring homosexuality incompatible with Christianity. But Webb Bowden reassured him. She did not think that language would stand. 42 years later, she stands in front of a cross at the pulpit, enveloped by an arched wooden ceilings inside Elizabeth Street United Methodist Church in Durham. Wearing a long white robe with gold accents and deep red lipstick, she preaches to some elderly and middle-aged churchgoers. It's the last Sunday of the Christian calendar, and the mood is somber. She says with a slight southern accent, referencing the book of Jeremiah, "Woe to you who have scattered my flock." Her voice does not bellow, but her message resonates. The scripture implores us to be inclusive of all. Next, she calls upon her congregation to pray for sick loved ones, expecting parents, and recent victims of a mass shooting at an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado. Beneath the formalities of pastorship and clergy robes, her conviction remains. She said in an interview, I've been fighting for inclusion from the very beginning. I'm not new to this party. Out of the pulpit, on a Wednesday afternoon web sports a pixie cut with a salmon pink trench coat and cat eye glasses. Her office is an amalgam of things, a pin board full of letters from family and friends, crosses, and the occasional photo of a cat, a bookshelf with a series of religious books, and a few plants around the room. Her days include planning sermons, studying scripture, and just talking to those who ask. She's married to a retired Methodist pastor, Larry Bowden, and a mother to four, two sons, Jacob and Charles, and two cats, Scamp and Mousy. Her demeanor is unassuming, with a certain amount of spunk. Webb Bowden was not what I expected when I decided to visit a pastor, but when she got up mid-interview to retrieve her hymnal and share a favorite song, her enthusiasm for the gospel was indisputable. She's always been passionate about God, but like her style, her path into ministry was unconventional. A self-described cradle Methodist, Webb Bowden was born in Montgomery, Alabama in 1959. At 5 years old, she moved to Atlanta with her family during the height of the civil rights movement. She's the granddaughter of sharecroppers from the Ozark Mountains and the daughter of parents who lived through the Great Depression. Her parents raised her with a progressive politic and a deep sense that social inequities are wrong. In some ways, it's obvious how her upbringing impacts her present work. For many years, she worked as the director of a faith-based nonprofit where she provided fresh produce to food-insecure communities in North Carolina. Now at Elizabeth Street, she and her congregation distribute food to the neighborhood during the first Monday of every month. They host a community meal with strangers and friends and leave their garden open to any hungry passerby. The church also serves as a meeting ground for multiple nonprofits working to reduce violence and drug addiction in Durham. Yet, Webb Bowden is also an anomaly. As one of the relatively few women pastors in the United Methodist Church, she didn't have many role models growing up. When she was 15, she went on a mission trip to Jamaica, where she discovered her desire to pursue a church vocation. But she believed she had limited options. She had never seen an ordained clergywoman before. She didn't receive much encouragement either. Her parents set low expectations, anticipating her to marry young or become a nurse. Nor were they very religious. Webb Bowden described her father as, at best, a deist, who was grateful his daughter was too smart to be a Jesus freak like his crazy sister in Texas. That sister claimed to have visions of Jesus while changing her bedsheets, recalled Webb Bowden. Nevertheless, she began to think she might pursue ministry while at Huntington College in Montgomery, Alabama. She majored in religion and philosophy, but was the only woman in the philosophy department. Again, finding little inspiration, she decided to attend Duke Divinity School to figure out her calling. While at Duke, Webb Bowden served as a hospital chaplain for UNC Health, where she provided spiritual guidance to patients in labor and delivery. It was in the crucible of neonatology that Webb Bowden emerged with a passion for pastoring. As a woman, she had never been invited into the worship setting to preach, but as a hospital chaplain working with patients in their most vulnerable state, she learned she had gifts for spiritual care. If she could handle the emergency room, certainly she could manage a church. She said, "I'm pretty fearless in relational aspects of ministry, and I have lots of chutzpah and moxie." Well, after attending Duke Divinity School, working as a pastor in rural North Carolina, and working as a nonprofit, Webb Bowden came to Elizabeth Street in July of 2021. Elizabeth Street had just been formed from the merging of two congregations. That's the Resurrection United Methodist and Calvary United Methodist. Buddy Dean, a 22-year-long member of Calvary and subsequently Elizabeth, said she was exactly what the church needed at the time. Now, good friends with Webb Bowden, he praised her for her knowledge of the Methodist doctrine and stirring speeches, which are sometimes embellished with a couple of cuss words. He said, "I think that brings her more down to human level. You know, I think she's being herself, but she's doing it in a Christian way." Unlike most other pastors, Dean said, Webb Bowden participates in pretty much every activity going on at Elizabeth Street. She gave blood during the church's blood drive and regularly participates in the community meals. She's also a strong advocate of the congregation's progressive Christian ideology. Calvary, which later became Elizabeth Street, claims to be the first reconciling congregation in North and South Carolina. In other words, the first Methodist church in the Carolinas to be inclusive of LGBTQ people. That welcoming culture is felt by members of the church like Dean. Calvary was the first church where Dean and his husband were truly welcome, he remembers. At their previous church, they felt as if they could not show affection. But at Calvary, they could be themselves. At Elizabeth Street, Webb Bowden continues to foster an inclusive community. Amy Laura Hall, an associate professor of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke's Divinity School, and a member of the church, wrote in an email that Webb Bowden made a good impression on her younger daughter and her daughter's girlfriend. Hall wrote, "They're not terribly eager to attend church things, but Webb Bowden impressed them. Julia doesn't talk down to people, but she does have a winsome, gritty wisdom about her." Not all congregations are so unified on the issue of welcoming LGBTQ people, though. In the fall of 2021, Pioneers Church, a previously Methodist church, opened a half mile away from Elizabeth Street. Webb Bowden worked with local activists to campaign against the new church, which was criticized for its stances on LGBTQ issues, including reported opposition to same-sex marriage. In response, Webb Bowden wrote an impassioned article in favor of inclusion. She wrote, "We can't think of a single instance when excluding people because of sexuality, race, ethnicity, religion, or gender was a good idea." Matthew Lardy, a queer activist in Durham, worked with Webb Bowden to protest the nearby church. Lardy is not a Christian and is skeptical of organized religion, he said, but he was struck by how friendly, open, and concerned Webb Bowden was. Quote, "This wasn't a turf war for her. She was immediately concerned about the harm this could do for the community, not just the potential harm or public relations harm it might cause the Methodist Church." In June of 2022, Pioneers disaffiliated from the Methodist Church and joined the Wesleyan denomination because of community pushback. Webb Bowden was proud of her congregation for their role in protesting that church. She said, "I hate what's happened for the gay community on Gear Street, and yet it has mobilized and helped Christian communities within this very gay community to be seen as something other than your grandma's Methodist church." This ideological divide also extends beyond Durham. Every year, Webb Bowden attends the annual gathering of the North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church, which exists to support Methodist churches around the eastern half of the state. But this year, 249 congregations, about 32% of that conference, moved to disaffiliate from the Methodist denomination because of the church's new stances allowing ordination of gay and lesbian clergy and permitting same-sex marriage. Webb Bowden said, "It's a divorce. It's really painful. I've worked really hard to help my congregation understand the devastation that's being felt by other congregations because it's just a non-issue here." Although other churches are experiencing deep divides, Elizabeth Street remains united. On a recent Sunday, the room buzzed with the excitement of old friends reuniting after a long time apart. Members wafted around the sanctuary, sharing greetings and personal updates. As a newcomer, I worried I'd interrupt their rituals, But any hesitation withered away as I was greeted like a welcome celebrity. "Chloe, welcome to our chaos," she cheered from the lectern. Dean and someone named Barbara gave me a hug, and others introduced themselves to me. As Webb Bowden began to speak, the crowd sat in captivation. Dean said, "She's a very good preacher. Her sermons are wonderful. Her knowledge of Methodist rules and regulations, or the Methodist disciplines, are just phenomenal. But she doesn't give herself so much credit." She said, "I would not say I'm a great preacher," she said with a smile, lounging in her office rocking chair. "I limp into the pulpit." All right, folks, unbeknownst to my thousands of listeners, there's an incident in the studio where I can no longer hear myself on my headphones. And for a fellow with a big ego, that's a big problem. And so I'm doing this by watching my meters alone on the board and hope that the sound is still getting through on my last 10 minutes of this issue of Indie Week. And so here comes an article by Gabi Mendick called "Preservation Station." Walking neighborhood streets in the Triangle, you're likely to come across a plethora of free goods, numerous household items with free sticky notes on curbs, little free libraries chock full of donated books, and various wooden structures containing dry goods and pantry items with signs reading "Free Food" or "Comida Gratis." Now, in the same spirit of giving back to the community and not the landfill, Durham has its first community fridge. After 18 months of planning, on October 29th, the refrigerator was plugged in and officially opened for business. Behind the Durham Community Fridge is a local mutual aid group that aims to mitigate food waste by providing open access to food. It's not a charity organization. Per the group's definition, mutual aid involves communities coming together to help meet the needs of everyone in the community. The refrigerator freezer, painted lavender and stocked with donated food, is located at St. Joseph's Episcopal Church in Durham on West Main Street. Alongside the fridge is a cabinet filled with dry food goods and personal care products, including essentials like toilet paper, feminine hygiene products, and condoms. And the issue of the Indie Week pays a picture of that very attractive light lavender refrigerator, which looks fairly full of food right now. All kinds of provisions, produce, dairy products, prepared meals, beverages, and more are regularly stocked. And beyond the contributions of individuals, the fridge also receives consistent weekly donations from local businesses and nonprofits, including Red's Quality Acre, the Durham Co-op Market, Iglesia Presbyteriana Emmanuel, Red Start Foods, Gear Street Learning Garden, and Happy Dirt. On a recent Friday morning, for instance, the fridge was stocked with a drawer full of root vegetables, 3-quart containers of homemade curry carrot soup, a tray of cornbread stuffing, 2 cartons of non-dairy milk, and much more, while the freezer held several bags of sliced bread. On its Instagram page, Durham Community Fridge post regular photo and video updates sharing the current contents. The phenomenon of community fridges first cropped up in Europe in the 2010s, and in recent years has made its way to the U.S. The onset of the pandemic heightened food insecurity and isolation and inflation, and as a result, grassroots efforts like community fridges have begun to emerge in more places. The online database Fridge lists more than 150 community fridges across this country. Because the fridge is a mutual aid effort and is fully run by and serves the community, both regulations and barriers to access are minimal. Much of the donated food is cooked in individuals' homes and in kitchens that are not certified or regulated. But unlike other food access programs, such as Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which have eligibility requirements and application processes, Accessing the fridge doesn't require filling out forms or providing documentation. All are welcome to participate, no matter their need level or income. Haley Paquette is a member of the Mutual Aid Group. Shares, social conditioning tells us you can only engage with something like this in the taking side of things when you are in dire need. This is an exercise in the leveling of a playing field, getting capitalism out of the picture, and giving and taking when and if you are able, without questions asked. The Durham Community Fridge Mutual Aid Initiative was founded by 9 individuals with a range of different backgrounds and skills who came together around a shared mission to feed their community. Before moving to Durham, one member of the group was involved in Miami's Community Fridge Network of 10 community fridges. Another has spent time working in Durham restaurants and borne witness to food waste, while a third member had purchased a new refrigerator for their home and wanted to donate their old one. The group coalesced around that refrigerator. That's a good image. With the objective of finding it a home base. One of the major initial challenges the group faced was finding a local space to host that fridge. The Mutual Aid Group shared over email with the Indy, many businesses were interested, but it was difficult to give them concrete examples of how the fridge would function without having an example here in Durham. Other businesses that expressed support were limited because they rent their property and didn't have the ability to build a structure for the fridge or provide an electricity source. The group finally connected with St. Joseph's Episcopal, and the two entities formed a harmonious partnership. The church designed and helped build a structure for the fridge, installed electricity on the church exterior, and built the pantry that sits alongside. Lachlan Hessman, Ministry Associate for Liturgy and Administration at St. Joseph, says, St. Joseph has a long-standing relationship with the unhoused population of West Durham, and the flagship of that is our 3-times-a-week community breakfast that brings a whole bunch of people together to eat. We have a beautiful location that we can't utilize enough. These community breakfasts are held on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 8 a.m. When the fridge was first installed and word spread there was an outdoor electricity source, there was initial issue with people unplugging the fridge in order to charge their phones and electronics. But the wrinkle was optimistically dealt with head-on. Organizers simply built an additional power source to accommodate people's needs. Just as anyone is welcome to take food from the fridge, all are welcome to donate to it. Donations from individuals are critical to keeping that fridge full throughout the week. If you cook an extra serving of soup or grow tomatoes more than you know what to do with, they can easily be dropped off at the fridge so long as it's labeled with its ingredients and either the date it was made or an expiration date. Since its inception, fridge volunteers have noticed a demand for ready-to-eat prepared foods, and donations from home cooks go a long way toward meeting that demand. The Durham Community Fridge does not currently accept monetary donations. They raised funds to start the fridge on Kickstarter and has a small reserve for maintenance and other expenses that come up. But otherwise, their focus is on a different kind of giving. And Paquette says, if you find yourself wanting to give, and where your mind goes with that is to give money, it's about this changing of mentality to instead make an extra loaf of banana bread and put it in the fridge. Volunteers play a key role in ensuring that the fridge is well maintained. Members of the community group visit every day to clean the unit and check the shelf life of the items stocked. Paquette says, we're monitoring. Every day we have someone in check, and that might entail opening a container of something and giving it a sniff. There's no precise formula, but just regular monitoring and using one's better judgment. The fridge is accessible 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, a schedule that acknowledges another aspect of people's different food needs. Other food assistant programs, like food pantries, usually have specific pickup windows, which can make them difficult to access for people with busy work schedules. It's also still very new to the community. And the Durham Community Fridge is still developing and fine-tuning its templates for future fridges in the Triangle. The group says it's an open-sourced food pantry on the street corner, propelled by the care we provide for each other. Community member Sharman Aziz says, "We want to remove the stigma that there's a specific need and specific people who deserve it. Everybody deserves food." Well, now, beloved listeners, I am reaching the end of my broadcast time, and I can't hear my gorgeous voice anymore because of the headphones. I will read some culture calendar as far long as time permits. Very little time permits. But starting tonight, which is January the 12th, Thursday, Severed Fingers and Jesse Da Silva are at the Pinhook in Durham. And most of these include admission fees. Adam Knight's Buried Alive, a tribute to Phish, Lincoln Theater in Raleigh. Anthony Hamilton is at DPAC in Durham on tomorrow, Friday. And also Friday at 8 p.m., Jim Ketch, Swing Tet at Sharp 9 Gallery in Durham. The North Carolina Symphony goes to Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances and other pieces, and that's at Duke Energy for the Performing Arts on 13th and 14th. Again, 13th, Steel Wheels at Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts, and Kuchulain, Honey Magpie, and Cameron Stenger at the Pinhook in Durham. At Local 506, Lame Fest 14 with WMF Bronco Andy Lame and the Halo of Vultures. That's in Chapel Hill. Saturday the 14th, Magic City Hippies over at Cat's Cradle in Carrboro. And I think I'd better stop our show for today from Indie Week. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, hearing our kazoo professionals begin to swarm in about our outdoor studio doors, and tell me, even though I can't hear myself, I hope you can, and I hope that our nuclear-trained engineers who come in during the week will help me get back to you for Indie Week from North Carolina Reading Service. So John Federson says, so long.